So believe it or not, we're almost halfway through the retreat. What? We're just getting started. But not to worry. The first couple of days, usually the landing takes more time. So after you arrive and you've landed, the rest will be smoother. But just to say, you know, time is precious. As of tonight, we'll be halfway through. And you know, we've offered teachings on metta, and tonight I'm going to talk about all the Brahmaviharas, the four Brahmaviharas, and talk more about what might already have been coming up in your practice and the ways to work with them. But before I get there, few things to share. And that is, I'm really appreciating hearing about the creativity that you've been invited to engage in, to make this practice work for you, finding a way to work for you. For some people, it's not images. For some people, it's a felt sense. It's physical. And trying to do something visual doesn't work. Fine, not a problem. See what works for you. I've had one person beautifully talking today about how they imagine their benefactor stroking their hair and comforting them and soothing them with just a feeling of love and metta. Beautiful. If that image that works for you, great. So be creative, whatever works for you. Also, feel free to change the phrases, choose the phrases and use the phrases such that they work for you. I've put some alternatives downstairs, and actually we'll share a handout with you that has many phrases, both from metta and the other Brahmaviharas that I will talk about tonight. But phrases such as, may I love and accept myself just as I am, or may I learn, or may I grow to love and accept myself just as I am, can be a very supportive phrase for some people. Or different varieties of the phrases that have been offered. As I've already mentioned in the guided meditation yesterday morning, I found it really supportive to say the phrases, or sometimes when they just become a word, safe, happy, healthy, ease, to synchronize them with my breath, with breathing, or if you're doing walking meditation, do some kind of a synchronizing so that it's more embodied, more physical. That sense of embodiment can come through that way. And also, for some of you, at some point, there could be the sense of radiating metta without words. Again, as mentioned, the words can drop, and it could just be a feeling with the being that you're doing metta for, and we'll talk more about radiating metta later also. And again, to say, when it feels, there are times that it will feel connected and perhaps juicy, and you're connected to the being and the feelings of metta, and there's some times that is just dry. It is so dry. Hang in there. Don't expect it to always feel juicy and wonderful and universal love. And through planting seeds when it is dry, you will drop into deeper places you wouldn't have expected. And I'm speaking from other people's practice and my own practice. It's also a practice of patience and perseverance. And also notice if you're over-efforting, if the practice seems too exhausting, you're tired, you're just trying to generate this metta. Oh, if that's happening, then I suggest pull back a little bit from the effort and fall into ease a little more. The resting, and realize that the idea is not so much to generate and pump it out, but just to turn your mind to what is already there. Because we all have a sense of warmth, so just by turning the mind there automatically, it will stoke the fire and it will grow. So don't feel like it's yours to generate. It's not yours to create. Metta, love, care, friendliness is you're sitting in a field of it. You're sitting in a field of it. And in a way, your heart is just recycling what's already there in the universe. It's a different view of metta. It's a more expanded, it's the awakened mind view of metta that, you know, we practice as individuals, as these limited beings, but in some way it's not yours. It just is. You're made of it. It's part of you. You are it. It's just being going through you. You're just turning your mind to it in order to cultivate your awareness of it. And your tendency, and the tendency for it to arise. Many of you have also talked about already the experiences of happiness that have come up for you on this retreat, the sense of happiness. Some of you have already talked about a sense of bliss that comes up, as well as the cycles of purification. So there could be bliss 1 hour, and the next hour is the purification of perhaps grief or sadness or forgiveness and things that need to come up. It's part of this practice. Metta tends to open up the doors we have locked for many, many years. It tends to open them gently. It's safe to come out. It's safe to come out and be processed. So make space for them. Make space for whatever woundedness or sadness might be coming up to be held in gentleness for healing. It is part of this practice. Many people have mentioned, is this normal? Yes, absolutely. This is what happens on a metta retreat, even more so on an insight retreat. There will be tears. Don't hold them back. There will be weeping. Don't hold it back. It is part of this process. You're not doing it wrong. Also talked about safety, and I wanted to say a little more about safety. The first phrase, may I be safe from inner and outer harm. May you be safe from inner and outer harm. Offering safety, a wish for safety. And really realizing that for ourselves, the biggest way that we are hurt is often the internal hurt that we cause through our own thinking and the way that we interact and we react to reality. So may I be safe from inner and outer harm. And in general, as I've been practicing actually here, it's occurred to me again, as I've been practicing with you, that really metta, the practice of metta itself, is the supreme protection, is the supreme protection of the mind and heart. As I've been sitting here and practicing with you, it's just abundantly clear to me that if my heart is resting with care, with metta, with ease for myself and externally, outside, there's a sense of safety that comes. I cannot be hurt. I become unoffendable. It's as if there is a shield of protection that my mind and my heart has. I cannot be offended. I cannot be hurt by you. I cannot be hurt by others' words or rejections, because the heart is imbued, resting in care and love, in self-acceptance, in metta. It's this not just the heart, but the mind. It's the supreme protection. And in that way, so not at all do we become callous and not respect other people's opinion, but actually it allows us, when we become unoffendable, then we actually have the capacity to respond wisely to others, compassionately, lovingly to others, instead of reactively, sort of being offended and offending them back, hitting them back. It's like, no need. Heart is already full. Heart is already protected with metta, offered safety too. And that is something that Bhante this morning was talking about, which I loved, when he was reading from that booklet made for the mother of friends who were deceased. The sentence that he read was, "There is no offender in the presence of an intelligent person or a wise person." I would say there is no offender in the presence of a wise, of the wise. And that's it. It's becoming unoffendable. When someone is wise, wisdom and metta, there's nothing to offend. And of course, it also ties in with anatta, teachings of not self. Yes, there is. Who is there to be offended? This causes and conditions coming together arising in this moment. So see that for yourself. You don't have to take my word for it. See that for yourself when you're practicing. When you're practicing, feel the safety that arises in your mind, in your heart. When you feel imbued with metta, your mind feels safe from itself. First of all, it feels safe from itself, from the judgments, from the rah, 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 you're not good enough, you're not doing this right, rah, 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 you know, all the arrows, from all the daggers that we inflict upon ourselves with judgments, with doubts, with all kinds of daggers, causes and conditions trained. So notice how your mind becomes safe internally to yourself, from yourself, and then from the other daggers, from all the memories and thoughts and from others. Like, there's a sense of peace and ease. So see for yourself. I also wanted to touch on, as we've been talking about, acceptance as love, and love as acceptance. And also making the distinction between accepting, allowing, versus approving or condoning, as Bhante was talking about. And I wanted to expand on that even more, because I think it's a really, really important point, and it can often be misunderstood or misconstrued. Really important. So there is a significant difference between allowing, accepting, and condoning, or acquiescing, or giving up, or acting on, which is on the other side of it, the other side of the spectrum. And acceptance also is not resignation. It's definitely not. It's like, oh, okay, I accept, whatever, I'll be a wet noodle, yeah, whatever. Uh-huh. That's not what we're trying to cultivate here in this practice. It's not, absolutely not. So in this part, I want to give credit to Tara Brach, because she has a nice way of explaining the difference, and I've borrowed some of the same things I'll be sharing from her. So accepting means that you're accepting how you're feeling right now with respect to whatever is happening in this moment. So it's allowing. It's allowing reality to be just as it is in terms of your feelings with respect to whatever is happening. So acknowledging that emotions are like a river, and if you put a dam over them, they don't go over. And it's like acceptance. It's neither validating, neither approving, neither giving more fuel to the emotion or what is happening. So putting a dam is like resisting it. No, you're not supposed to be here. I'm not supposed to feel this way. Not accepting. No, I'm not supposed to feel sad. No, stop. That's like putting a dam. Condoning is like, giving more fuel and putting more fuel in the fire. Whereas allowing, accepting, what we're really talking about is, this is what's happening right now. This is the reality of this moment. For example, if this body is sick right now, it's like this. I can't resist it and say, stop feeling sick. I hate it. Your body's feeling, you're letting me down. Allowing or accepting is accepting reality just as it is in this moment. It doesn't mean giving up and saying, well, this is it. This is reality. Okay, fine. It doesn't mean you stop taking medication or you don't aspire to get better or have full health. It just means that you're accepting that it's like this right now. You don't resist reality. You don't resist that things are like this right now. It is like this. Ah. And that allows space, that frees up a lot of psychological space, a lot of psychological energy that was spent resisting, refusing, it shouldn't be, no. It frees all of that up in order to take wise action. So acceptance allows you to take wise action. Acceptance does not mean you don't do anything. You become a wet noodle. You see how this works? It actually frees you up to act out of wisdom. So accepting reality of the moment becomes a stepping stone for wise action. Whereas if you're stuck in resistance, you're just stuck. You're not going anywhere. You're wasting energy. So again, when we say accept, it's about accepting the truth of how things are right now. It's not resisting reality just as it is right now. It's like this. It has to be like this. If it could be any other way, it would have been. It has to be like this because of all the causes and conditions that have come together that are way above and beyond your control. So many histories, generations, so many causes and conditions, weather, political systems. It's just so many causes and conditions that have come together. Familiar history, genetics, etc., etc. Our minds can completely explode. Actually, that's what the Buddha said. One of the imponderables is the law of karma, is the law of causes and conditions. And that's exactly what he's pointing to. If you try to figure out all the causes and conditions that have led to this, whatever this is happening, let's say something that has happened in your life, so many causes and conditions, your mind would explode, your head would explode. So appreciating and acknowledging the complexity and bowing to that, the mystery of being human. We feel like, we think like, or we want to have full control over the whole show. We don't. We just don't. So humbly, we put one step in front of another and we cultivate to the best of our ability the midst of all this. I like to change gears and talk a little bit about the benefits of metta, the benefits of practicing loving kindness meditation. There are 11 benefits, and you might have heard the list before. And Let yourself hear it as if for the first time and be inspired. And see which of these you've experienced to be true in your experience and which one would be nice. Spiritual goodies. Number one, you will sleep easily. Maybe not on retreat. Retreat are special circumstances. Sometimes sleep can be more disturbed on retreat. But with metta in general, you will sleep more easily. Number two, you will wake easily. Number three, you will have pleasant dreams. Number four, people will love you. Number five, devas, which is celestial beings or angels in the Buddhist cosmology, and animals will love you. Devas will protect you. This next one, number seven, haven't tried. I would not necessarily recommend you try this at home. But anyway, here it is from the commentaries. External dangers such as weapons, poisons, and fire will not harm you. I wouldn't test it out. Your face will be radiant. This one is true. This one is definitely true. Your mind will be serene. Absolutely. This one I can personally attest to. You will die unconfused. This one I don't know yet. Last one, number 11. You will be reborn in happy realms. And whether you take this practice, or you take the cosmology as multi-life model with rebirth, or you take a single life model, if you take the single life model, then you will be reborn in happy realms. Just think about how, you know, if you're all cultivating, practicing metta and kindness and friendliness towards yourself and towards others, in this moment, in the next moment when you take birth, you will be reborn in a happier realm, right? So you're seeing it as a one life model. Whatever you do in this moment, it preconditions how you will be reborn in the next moment. A happier birth will take place. I mean, we know this, right? If you're thinking kind thoughts, you'll be happier. And we don't, it's just known. And yet, there's also research studies about metta meditation and compassion meditation suggesting that yes, in fact, there are psychological changes for increased happiness and well-being. And I'll mention a few, and again, many of these studies are suggestive. They're not conclusive. Often the sizes are very small, etc., etc. They can't be double-blind for obvious reasons. So they're suggestive, not conclusive, so take them all with a grain of salt. And there are studies suggesting that this practice, it increases love, joy, contentment, gratitude, hope, interest, amusement, and awe feelings. That it increases sense of purpose in life and decreased illness symptoms, that it increases life satisfaction, which is the perceived quality of life. It reduces depressive symptoms. It improves resilience and stress and immune response. I'm not going into any details about the studies. But in terms of blood cortisol level and the stress-induced immune response, it's shown that this practice actually improves your immune response. It also leads to physiological changes, and the telomere length, which is a biological marker of aging, it's been observed. This is actually a very interesting study. And women who, this was a study with women who practiced loving kindness, and they had longer telomere length compared to age-matched control. So put away the beauty creams, practice loving kindness. Also increases this practice, and again, we don't need scientists to tell us this. We know that it increases the feeling of social connection, feeling more connected. In fact, I've had some yogis tell me, one yogi was sharing beautifully that, you know, at the beginning of the retreat, when I was sharing that, when I was saying that, you know, this, the retreat is going to, it's all going to work like clockwork, and it was their first retreat, they wondered, I wonder how it's going to work, all in silence, without talking. Okay, I'll trust it. I'll see how it works. And they were sharing that they're amazed that it works. And for them, this feeling of being in the metta field, really being in a metta field with others that they didn't know, but they felt... this is not their words, but my best recollection, they felt love for people they didn't know, that they felt like they were in this field of metta. So, of course, this practice increases your sense of connection, social connection. It's lovely. It does that. It increases empathic response, and also it decreases implicit bias towards social outgroup. I think this is a really interesting, also promising research result for this, because, you know, it is shown that human beings, whether or not we like it, there is implicit bias towards social outgroup, people who are not like us, they're different. For whatever reason, it's implicit. It's in our biology, you know, survival through millions of years of evolution. And this practice decreases that implicit bias. Yay! Isn't that wonderful? The bias we don't even know we have. So promising. This practice reduces self-criticism, which is highly correlated with depression, with depressive symptoms. Which makes sense when there is the judgmental mind. You're not doing this well enough, you're failing, you're like, oh, after a while, you know, of course, depression sets in, right? Oh. So a practice that can alleviate, can reduce the self-criticism, of course, can support, can decrease depression and depressive symptoms. And in this particular study, the results were maintained when they tested even 3 months afterwards. The depressive symptoms were reduced through this practice. And also some research on how the practice of loving kindness has decreased migraines, as well as a chronic pain, chronic lower back pain, as well as the pain and anger and psychological distress associated with illness. Because a lot of times with illness and chronic pain, it's not just the pain itself, but it's all the psychological, the second arrows that we hit ourselves with. The first arrow is the illness. It's okay, life has hit us with an arrow. Okay, here it is. What to do? The second arrow is, why is it here? Why am I better? I'm suffering. This is terrible. I'll never get better. Or, you know, there's so many things. Or why me? Why me? What did I do wrong? Or I hate my body. It's failed me. Like, there's so many different narratives. This practice can help let go of the second arrows, so that we can just work with the first and just one arrow. It's just one. It's much easier to deal with, not easier to work with. the Dalai Lama says, if you want to be happy, practice compassion. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. Practice compassion. Whoever you want to be happy, practice compassion. Say a little bit about my relationship to the practice of metta. It's really dear to me, practice of metta and all the Brahmaviharas, which I'll expand on in a minute. I dedicated about a year of my life to this practice. So metta practice, metta and compassion, loving kindness and compassion, were my daily practice for about a year. And actually, that's also the time I was going through a teacher training program at Stanford University at CCARE, the Center for Compassion and Altruism Research and Education. And also I've sat long retreats just dedicated to practicing the Brahmaviharas. And also for me, I have a chronic illness, so the practice of self-compassion, it's become a go-to. It's become really what has supported me to have freedom in the midst of suffering, in the midst of pain, in the midst of physical difficulty and pain that I work with every day. And this practice, I would say it has changed me. It really has shifted my perspective and changed me. I'm not the same person I was before I started this practice. So anyone can do this. It's not special about me. Anyone can do this. This practice changes you. It completely changes you. And I still have a lot more practice to do, a lot more growing to do in many ways. And I'm never done. I don't want to be done. And I'm changed and I'm grateful for it. And I'm looking forward to more change in the coming years. So I share this in the hopes of inspiring you that it is possible. Here I am, an example. I know I've changed in significant ways. This is a beautiful, meaningful practice, and it's time well spent, really time well spent doing this practice. I would say it's my favorite practice. It's hard to choose a favorite practice. I have so many favorite practices. Death contemplation is a favorite practice too. So is emptying. But anyway, I'll stop. Okay. Brahmaviharas. Okay, now that you're on the edge of your seat, as I've promised to talk about the Brahmaviharas, all four of them. So, Brahmaviharas. Literally translated as abodes of Brahma. Brahma Vihara. Vihara is abode, is home. Brahma is the gods. Brahma are the gods, or heavenly. So translates to heavenly abodes, heavenly dwelling, or sublime attitudes is another way it's translated. Also known as the four immeasurables, the four Brahma Viharas. So the name is interesting, right? The realm of the gods, heavenly abodes. And oh, you know, in the past, when I was an early practitioner, it sounded really lofty, like heavenly abodes. Wow, what the heck does that mean? And it wasn't until I did a dedicated practice for a long retreat, just doing Brahmaviharas. Every day, day in, day out, continuity, walking, sitting, lying down, eating, going to bathrooms, like metta, all the time. That the sense of bliss and happiness that opened was like heaven on earth. Really, for me, it was the most sublime experience of heaven on earth. Like, this is what they're talking about. This is the heavenly abode. If there was a heaven, this is what it would feel like to be in it. It's the sense of happiness and bliss and ease. And also it's taught as you practice these practices, you, as I mentioned, as the number 11, you'll be born in happy realms. But again, either multi-life or in this very life, you will be born in a happy realm, in the realm of the gods. So the four Brahmaviharas, the first one that we've been talking a lot about, because in this tradition, in the Theravada tradition, metta, loving kindness, friendliness, is considered the central one, considered the main one, from which the other three kind of come out of and relate to. Just to say, in the Tibetan tradition, compassion is the central one, and the other ones relate to it. But here, the metta is the central one, and the other three relate to. So just to mention the four, first one, metta, loving kindness. The second one is vicarious joy or sympathetic joy. I'm sorry, it's actually, no, that's the third one. Great. See, my memory is failing too, Bhante. I did that intentionally. Never mind. The second one in the traditional order is karuna, compassion. The third one, mudita. I love mudita. Mudita, vicarious joy. Joy for the joy of others. And the last one, equanimity or upekka. Upekka, equanimity. So how do they relate to each other? So, as we've been talking about metta or friendliness, goodwill, it's basically just the friendliness of the heart. The friendliness of the heart that it basically touches a person who's in a neutral circumstance, not suffering, not really happy, just wishing them well. May you be safe, may you be happy, may you be healthy, may you have ease. It's just this friendliness that's expressed. Now, this friendliness of the heart, if it comes across an object, a being, when I say object, I really mean being, comes across a being, this friendliness, who is suffering, who is in pain, metta becomes compassion. It expresses itself as compassion because it's holding the suffering with care, with love. So the same metta becomes, when it comes across suffering, whether it's your own suffering or somebody else's suffering, it gets expressed as compassion. Ah, holding the pain. Oh dear, oh sweetie, may you be free from the suffering. I care about your pain. So it's the holding of the pain, holding of the sorrow. The same goodwill, metta, when it comes across a being who is doing great, really happy, having great fortune right now. They've just won the lottery or got the job they've always wanted or whatever, happy in their life in some way. That goodwill, when it touches good fortune, it becomes sympathetic joy. I'm so happy for your happiness. May your happiness continue. May it never end. You know, have you ever felt happy for somebody else's happiness as if it were your own? I am so happy for you, right? You've had that experience, right? People you care about? Yes, wonderful. So that is mudita. That's when metta touches, comes in contact with good fortune. It becomes happiness for somebody else's happiness. And the Dalai Lama says, when you're just happy for your own happiness, you have one chance of being happy. When you're happy for other people's happiness, your chances increase by 7 billion. And then there is upekkha, equanimity, which is the fourth, brahmavihara. So upekkha, there are a couple of ways to understand upekkha, understand equanimity, and how it fits here, how it fits with the other brahmaviharas that feel kind of warm and loving, and equanimity seems kind of cool. So why is it here? Great, hold on to this question. Let this question be, I'll explain. So one way to understand equanimity is that when the mind comes across, when metta comes across a suffering that is so overpowering, that is so strong, that compassion can't quite hold it, then equanimity becomes the wise response. So it's when then love, metta, and wisdom merge together and become equanimity. Because equanimity has this bird's eye view of reality, of what is happening. In fact, upekkha, the word in Pali, means to see, to oversee, overview, a bird's eye perspective that's not caught. So if you went up, up, up and got a bird's eye view on reality, you see the causes and conditions and it's a relaxing. You see the uncontrollability, all the causes and conditions. So metta expands with this wisdom view of how things are, how things really are, all the causes and conditions. And equanimity in itself is the perfect, unshakable balance of mind, which is rooted in insight, in this wisdom. And equanimity neither moves towards, neither falls into, grasps, and neither falls away from, neither pulls away. It's just right there. It's right there, stable, just present, just present. Now, the thing to note about equanimity, and again, I didn't know this until I was practicing equanimity as a practice intensely, is equanimity is not aloof. Equanimity is not checked out. It's not like, yadi-da-di-da, things are as they are. It's part of the Brahmaviharas because there is warmth, there is care. There is care. That's why we stay present. We stay present with wisdom, not falling into it and not aversion pulling away from it. It's caring. It's that caring presence that is stable, unshakable, but it has the care. It has the warmth as a part of it, right? If it didn't have the care, the love, it would become aloofness. Right? It would become indifference, which is the near enemy, which I'll talk about in a moment. And again, to say that we do all these practices not for attachment to outcome, not because we want something to happen, somebody who's really suffering to be free of their suffering. No magical thinking. It's freedom. It's so that our heart becomes trained. Our heart becomes free in working with and holding suffering with love and care, and does not run away from it, does not deny it, does not push it away, does not hate it, does not become angry in the face of it, so that it can become strong. Hold it with care, not hate it, not run away. Similarly with all the other Brahmaviharas. So with respect to the near and far enemies, just to remind you that near enemy is the quality that can masquerade as the original. And the far enemy is just the opposite, just plain, just the opposite, easy to recognize. The near enemy is harder to recognize. So pay attention in your practice. So as I've already mentioned, but just to review, with metta, the far enemy is easy. It's hatred, it's anger, it's ill will, easy to recognize. And it can come up in your practice when you least expect it. And again, consider it purification. And also, notice if your mind, as you're trying to develop metta, if it ever becomes brittle, like with the sounds in the room or people doing something like, stop doing that, I'm trying to cultivate kindness. Right? Watch out for that in your mind. So friendliness towards everything and everyone. And every little opportunity is an opportunity for practice in your mind. Every opportunity is an everything that happens on retreat and in daily life. Let's just take retreat. Is an opportunity for practicing. Nothing left out. Friendliness towards everything and everyone. The near enemy, as mentioned, just reviewing, is attachment, is love with strings attached, transactional love. I love you so that you love me back. I will do this for you so you love me back. Love with strings attached. It's also attachment to outcome, right? It's the same idea of attachment. Now, compassion, karuna, has different... let's talk about the far enemy first, the easy one. The far enemy of karuna, compassion, is cruelty. Just cruelty. When you see someone suffering, being cruel to them. That's easy to recognize, right? The near enemy, a couple of things. One is pity. Pity is a near enemy of compassion. And why is that so? Pity is a sense of, oh, poor you. Oh, poor you. Oh, that would never happen to me, right? It's a less than. It's like, oh, I'm up here, you're down there. It's a sense of pity, right? Whereas compassion is, oh, this could happen to me. This could be me. I hold your suffering with care. This could be me. We're not so different. We suffer in the same way. We can suffer in the same way. This could be me. So pity is a near enemy. So watch out for it if you're kind of like distancing yourself from somebody's suffering. The other near enemy is sympathetic distress. Sympathetic distress is when there's only empathy, and there's only empathy, you're only feeling, you're only resonating with somebody's distress or your own distress, pain, but not enough love and care to balance it out. So you're just falling into how painful it is. Oh, this is awful. This is terrible. So it's almost like falling. If somebody is suffering and bobbing up and down in the ocean waves, you kind of fall in with them and bob up and down. Okay. Instead of having handhold and care and love and feeling their pain. So you have stability to actually have the stability of compassion comes from having the care, having the love to balance the feeling of the pain. Does that make sense? The two balance each other. And to say what really supports this balance is equanimity. So practicing compassion, it will come up, by the way. So I'm mentioning the Brahmaviharas, by the way, because say you're sitting, you're practicing, you're doing metta, and you're doing metta for your dear friend, and oh, all of a sudden you remember, oh, actually they're really hurting in this particular way, and their relationship is really hurting. And oh, so now your metta has come across suffering. So now you're practicing compassion. Surprise! Now you're practicing compassion. It's the appropriate response, so recognize that. So holding the suffering with care. So these practices can kind of change into one another. Don't say, oh, stop, stop. I'm practicing metta. I'm not going to do compassion. Doesn't matter. The Brahma Viharas are related. You're going to go back and forth between them because of whatever might be appropriate response in a given moment, it what arises in your life, in your practice. Or it might be that you're practicing for your dear friend and you realize, you remember, oh, gosh, they're so happy right now. And like, I'm so happy for your happiness. Ah, it becomes mudita. It becomes vicarious joy, right? Metta to mudita, etc. So just to continue with near enemy of compassion, sympathetic distress or empathetic distress is when you're just holding and falling into the pain and the sorrow and not enough care, not enough love to soothe and balance it, and also not enough equanimity. So imagine equanimity as this stable bedrock that you're sitting on. So not tipping into, not tipping away from. The bedrock of equanimity allows you to be with suffering without pushing it away, like, oh, that's too much, or your own suffering, oh, running away from it, oh, I can't be with this. Equanimity allows you to be with it with love, with care. So neither falling into it with empathetic distress, not running away from it, pushing it away. And of course, remember to titrate. This is very important. I'm not suggesting, and please do not make yourself go, just jump into the suffering. Okay, I'm going to have compassion even if it kills me. Just titrate yourself, titrate. If at some point, if you have been with something that's been difficult for you to be with, for yourself or someone else, if your heart says, okay, time for a break, time to turn to easy person, or time to have metta for the birds, just to take a break. Respect that. Respect taking a little break. Respect what your wisdom mind is telling you, titrating. Continuing with sympathetic joy, mudita, joy at the good fortune of others. The far enemy is easy to recognize. Envy is when we are feeling happy for somebody else's happiness, like, I want that. Why do they have it? I wish I would had it. They didn't have it. Oh, okay, envy. Oh, sweetie. Oh, then it becomes compassion for self. You're really suffering right now. You really want, I don't know, you really want $1 million too. Oh, whatever it is, you know. Whatever it might be. I don't know what envy might occur. Right? So recognize, and then the appropriate response would be to work with it, to work towards the pain, which in at that point, the envy is your pain. So it becomes self-compassion. The near enemy is the near enemy of mudita, sympathetic joy, is overexuberance. That's an interesting one. Actually, there are two of them. One is pride. The other one is overexuberance. Overexuberance is when you get so high, like happy for the other person's happiness, that it's like you're drunk. It's like you feel lightheaded. And I've been there. It's very interesting. It's not sustainable. I don't recommend it. So recognize it. It's a sense of overexuberance. That's not balanced. Again, it doesn't have the stability of upekkha, equanimity. And the other one is kind of the sense of pride. Oh, like my child, my team. I'm happy for your happiness as if it's yours. You're taking, like, it's not offered without any attachments, without any strings attached. There's strings attached. Oh, you're happy because you've had something to do with it, right? It's not clean. You see what I'm talking about? Yeah. So that's the near enemy for the for mudita, appreciative joy. Last one, upekkha. The far enemy is either greed or resentment. So either greed falling into it, like or attaching to it, or resenting, pushing it away. So either pulling or pushing, because equanimity is stable. The near enemy, as I've already talked about, is indifference. It's like, I don't care. Things are just as they are, whatever. That is not equanimity. That's indifference. That's aloofness. A lot more I can say, but plenty has been said, and it's 5 o'clock. So let's just sit and let the words settle. Thank you for your kind attention.